Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown James Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 291st episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 290 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you will also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation from of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. We always have some great guests, and just one continuing tonight. I hope you'll all join me next week and every week at the same time. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. First, personal. My latest book, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009, and a short story, all revealing my feeling for the present occupant of the White House, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I'm in the middle of editing the Hudson Valley Anthology of 2019, a collection of the writing of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release in late September or early October. And now some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, usually at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So September's meeting will be on Wednesday, September 18th, at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is surprisingly on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Cherbourg, New York, at 6 p.m. In September, the Mahopac workshop will meet on this coming Wednesday, September 11th, while the Yorktown one will next meet on Wednesday, September 25th. The aforementioned John C. Hart Library in Cherbourg will be hosting the Meet the Author session on Saturday, September 21st, from 1 to 3 p.m. I will be one of the six featured authors, as will the many-time guest on this show, Vinnie D'Aquino, author of a recent profile on the local revolutionary hero, Sybil Ludington. Finally, the September open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on Friday, September 20th, the night before the John C. Hart program I just mentioned, in the scenic Philipsy Mountain train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. The featured artist that night will be poet Van Hartman, the previous guest on this show. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings may be found at writerscenter.org. That's writerscenter, one word, WRITERSCENTER.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Down to this week's show, as mentioned, the 291st in the series. Tonight I am joined by poet, translator, and college professor Janine Pittis. Other than recent emails, this will be my first interaction with Janine, who comes highly recommended by a guest, as a guest by the fan of this show, Therese Crane Birch. It was Therese who previously recommended such super previous guests as publisher James Paul Wagner and Stonewall veteran and poet Rusty Rhodes. But I expect tonight to continue this tradition. The listeners wishing to join Janine and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Janine, and welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, yes, my pleasure. Would you start us off with a poem?
I'd love to. When we were human, when we lived in houses like books, lining the shelves of Borges' library, when each of our stories was a hagiography in the Encyclopedia of Saints, when we sat around kitchen tables sipping tea, words floating from our lips like butterflies bearing enormous scrolls, when we unraveled that parchment and still understood the strange cursive letters that moved and flowed like worms beneath the earth, when we stuck our heads out the slow train's windows, beneath us the rails were singing, when we got lost in a forest of conifers, when we made a wrong turn and ended up in the next town, when we took pictures of wasps, for they too were made of light, when we watched the rain falling gently on mushrooms, when we stepped over wet stones in the dark forest, when we searched for stars in the mist, when the hum of mosquitoes was still the holiest prayer, when the veins of our hands were still roots and flowers sprouted from them as we grew old. Now that we know all movement is rotation, now that we know we are motionless stars, now that we search for ammonite fossils in the marble floors of shopping malls, reaching to touch the galaxy's spiral, feeling only cracks. Now that we neither kneel on pebbles at the river's edge nor stare down at it from high crags. Now that we would never stop to stroke the scales of a forest snake. Now that we don't stand up to pray the Angelus at noon and our voices no longer touch each other like folded hands. Now that all our languages have converged into a single word that we repeat again and again. It is said that we have not changed. We are told we are as we always were. If anything, we are greater now, closer to those angels we once prayed to. We are told we should be grateful as we drift from now to now. We are told that we are still human. But I don't believe it.
Powerful ending. You don't feel that we're in a transition the way that we were when we moved from the oral tradition to reading. You don't feel that we'll get it right eventually.
That we'll get the transition from the oral tradition to reading. Can you elaborate a little on your question?
Well, we said that changed the brain that we used to rely on dealing with people to tell us to what happened, whether it's in the story in the Bible, to whether it's the fire god, whether it's to whatever they believed. Then after the printing press, then we wound up with reading ourselves, a more solitary experience. And there's been examination of the brain from before and after, and the brain's different. Now people will feel that there's the same things happening as we've gone to not being able to read long books because we're used to jumping around on the internet. Our requirements of memorization changes because we can find anything through Google. And we become even more solitary, perhaps. And eventually, we got it right after we started reading. Don't you feel that there's some probability that we'll get it right as we understand how to deal with our electronic devices?
I really don't know. I mean, there's a lot of research and a lot of thoughts on that topic. Sherry Turkle out of MIT has some really disheartening research on how technology alienates us from one another. Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, it's a similar idea. I think that definitely these devices that we're using today are very addictive, they provide instant gratification, and there is research, and I mean, I see it all the time as a teacher. My students are so dependent on their phones, and actually talking to one another has become more difficult. I was actually just talking about it with a work colleague the other day. He was mentioning how just walking into a classroom and to dead silence rather than students chattering. But will we get it right? Well, will we still be here in 100 years? I don't want to be overly negative. I hope so. If we do, if we manage to overcome these many challenges that we're facing now as a human species, I'd like to think that we can create a more just and compassionate way of being with one another, but it's hard to know what will happen.
Gotta agree, and I'm familiar with both Sherry and with Carr. Now, Sherry, I from email years ago when we started down this path, I think that she's more optimistic than Carr, who was with The Shallows. I found to be the very downer book. There's a very good book on research in this area, I think, called from, and the writer's name is going to escape me, from Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, and he quotes some of the research that we mentioned about change to the brain and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful, like you, I walk into my classroom and there are people not talking, and in some cases they may even be emailing each other or they may be texting each other.
In the same room,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but I've been able to, up until now, say, okay, put them away now. If you don't want to put it away, you can leave. And it's worked out. But the school has to support that, obviously. So, all right, let's go to the beginning. So where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Buffalo, New York. And early school, you mean like really early? I was actually born early and put into a special school run by Felician Franciscan Sisters at the age of 18 months.
Wow. Wow. And did you stay there right through grammar school?
No, it was a school for children with disabilities and also a kind of early childhood type school. So then I went to a different Catholic school for grammar school called Infant of Prague.
Oh,
unfortunately closed now, but that's where I grew up.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
My earliest aspirations. You mean like what I wanted when I was a child, what I wanted to be as an adult, like how I envisioned the future, or you mean just sort of day-to-day aspirations?
What you wanted to be as an adult?
My very first ambition was to be a news broadcaster. I wanted to be a news anchor on TV.
And you were an early reader?
No, I did not start learning how to read until first grade, which is the typical age.
Okay. And then what did you do after grammar school? Where did you go to high school?
Also a Catholic school, all girls, called Narden Academy in Buffalo, originally founded by a religious order called the Daughters of the Heart of Mary. But by the time I was there, the only sisters around were the president of the school and one librarian. Other than that, it was all lay teachers, but they were excellent.
Did your interest change then? Did you decide to be something other than a news anchor?
Well, I mean, I had a lot. My interest changed all the time. As a kid and as a teenager, I had a lot of things I wanted to be. I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to be a social worker. I wanted to be a musician. I think I started wanting to be a writer when I was 12 or so. But I actually did take the news anchor thing fairly seriously. When I was 20, I did an internship at a local television news channel in Buffalo, New York. But that was, I think it was around that time when I did the internship that the glamour of it faded pretty quickly.
Did you write for a school paper in high school or for the literary journal?
I did. I wrote for both.
And were you into poetry then? Or was it's straight prose or was it opinion? What kind of writing did you do?
I did some news type pieces for the newspaper, and for the literary magazine, I mostly did poetry. I started writing poetry regularly when I was about 12.
Wow, that's terrific. Speaking of poetry, then, how about another poem?
Another poem? All right. Okay. Roadside Madonna. There was a time when deities spoke directly to us. their words upon our lips, their hands entwined with ours. A time when our love, our chores, even our fighting was a dance for the gods who moved us. But then the music stopped, and they stood up and left, even though we begged them to stay. We built you, roadside Maria, crowned you in flowers and caped you in blue, with the hope that you would convince them. But for all this time, no one has come, and still you stand at the roadside waiting. And whenever I pass by, even though your cloak is chipped away, you still stretch out your arms. And as you place your hands in mine, for one moment, I forget I'm waiting in vain. We both forget we're stone.
That's very nice. That's hopeful, though. It ties us in. It's not down of like the end of like the lines in American Pie that the people I admire the most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, have caught the last train for the coast. I think in other words, they're out of here.
Yeah, it's such a sad song. Yeah.
What happened after high school?
I was very lucky. I got to go to Sarah Lawrence College, which was not something I expected, and I would say it was life-changing for me. My high school was as well, but college was life-changing in many ways. Probably the most difficult was that I was in your neck of the woods, Westchester County, and during my first week of school, I woke up one morning and saw that the energy on campus was kind of strange. And then I got a call from my mother saying that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center, and I ran down to the campus, student campus center, and there was a television on, and I saw another plane crash into the other tower. And I mean, it's funny because at that stage of my life, despite having wanted to be a newscaster, I was so preoccupied with just me, my own life. I wasn't really paying much attention to the news or what was going on in the world, and that was a pretty rude awakening that morning, as it was for many, many people. But I think something about it happening during my first week of college made an impact.
Now we're just coming up on an anniversary, and they just finally funded the fund for the first responders who have cancer and all that from running in. Mm-hmm. What'd you major in at Sarah Lawrence?
Well, Sarah Lawrence College is they have a different educational system based on John Dewey and other ideas of that were very progressive at the time when it was founded in the 20s. So they don't actually have majors. They have concentrations. All students get a BA in liberal arts. I would say that if people generally ask what my major was, I'd say literature, but I don't say English because I studied some English literature, but also Latin American literature in Spanish. And I also took a few courses in philosophy. So, yeah, the equivalent of a major would be literature. The equivalent of a minor would be philosophy, I'd say.
You mentioned Dewey and progressive. I taught for a number of years at the New School, which he was one of other founders of, and it was based on his ideas. It was very similar to that. And then what happened after college?
So after college, I was a little unsure of which direction to take. So my ambitions had changed from journalism to education. I kind of had a difficult time actually choosing between journalism and education, and I ultimately chose education, but I decided to keep doing journalism as a hobby. And I also had this crazy travel bug because I had studied abroad in my third year at Sarah Lawrence. They had an exchange program over at the University of Oxford, so I went there, and I came back, and my own country, I think especially with the two wars that had started and everything, was just a confusing place, and I just had this thirst to see other places. So I actually was very fortunate to get a grant through the U.S. government, the Fulbright organization, to teach and do a translation project in Uruguay in 2006, which is a wonderful country between Argentina and Brazil that rarely makes the news except when they reach the quarterfinal of the World Cup or become the first country in the world to legalize marijuana. Otherwise, you don't hear much about Uruguay, but there's a lot that should be heard about it, including amazing, amazing poets from there. So I went there first. I also went to Poland, which is the country that I identify with as my ethnic heritage. I'm Polish American. And so I learned Polish there. I studied the language. I'd learned a little as a kid, but I wanted to learn more. And before committing to graduate school, I did want to get a real world type job and be a full-time teacher and have students that I worked with every single day. But that was a little hard to come by. I applied to various private schools in the U.S., but I ended up getting hired by an international school in Nicaragua. So I stayed there for 1 year. It turned out to be very challenging work, and so I only stayed 1 year and then went to graduate school after that.
You mentioned the Polish heritage and the language. Have you ever been to Our Lady of Częstochowy outside of Philadelphia? It's a national Polish shrine, and my in-laws are buried there, and we went down, and they have buses from all over, at least the northeast coming, and I've been to Polish masses there. Not that I understood anything other than what I'd seen as a child, but it's a very interesting place.
I've never been there.
Okay.
I've never been there, but I've been to the original shrine of Our Lady of Częstochowa, which is in Poland between Kraków and Warsaw.
Oh, that must have been inspiring.
It really was. It was amazing.
Oh, where'd you go to grad school?
University of Toronto in Canada.
So that was another trip out of the country for you.
Yeah, in total, I really spent 10 years outside of the United States, basically from 2005 through 2015. I was almost continuously, other than brief visits home to Buffalo, I was almost continuously outside of the U.S.
And what did you... What did you go to grad school for? What's your master's in?
So I got a master's and a PhD in comparative literature. I mean, it was a good discipline for someone who can't make up their mind. I loved Spanish. I loved Polish. I loved English. I liked philosophy. So my main hesitancy with getting into academia, besides knowing that there weren't a lot of jobs at the other end, was the high degree of specialization. And I'm more of a generalist by nature, you know, a nice way of saying I'm kind of a dilettante sometimes. So this was a way that seemed appropriate to bring together many different interests and make connections. And I really did love it very much.
You've published 3 chapbooks. Let's take them one by one. Please tell us about Our Lady of the Snow Angels, which you published in 2012.
That was my first published chapbook, and it was really lovely how that came about. There's a poet in Toronto named Luciano Jacobelli, and he ran for many years this press, and actually he still runs it, but he's changed its focus. But it's called Lyrical Miracle, and he makes these wonderful handmade books, and he recycles old books, takes the covers, you know, I don't know, chemistry textbooks from 1975, things like that, and remakes them, uses dental floss to stitch them together. And it's really not known outside of Toronto. It's just a one-man operation. In fact, he's a teacher as well, and he started working with students with special needs, and I think that's how he started it. He was having them make their own books. And so he started this press, and a lot of well-respected poets within Toronto and that Ontario, Southern Ontario region have been published by him. So I approached him. I just had heard of him. I approached him, and he actually wrote back immediately and said, well, I really only publish poets who have a certain following in Toronto, who do readings, who get into journals, get active in the community, and come back in a year. So that's what I did. I started getting more active, going to readings, reading myself in public. And I came back, showed him my work, and he decided to publish it. So that's how I started.
Terrific. Now, your second one in 2015, A Place to Go, was that also published by him?
It was, yes.
And tell us about, first tell us about the content of Our Lady of the Snow Angels and then of A Place to Go.
Sure. So the content of Our Lady of the Snow Angels, actually the 2 poems that you just heard me read are from that collection, though I included them in my first full-length book, which just came out as well. But it really was that theme of religion, the search for God, when sometimes God is not apparent, as well as poems of love and friendship and family. And then I'd say A Place to Go was a lot more narrowly focused. It was a whole short chapbook of elegies and elegiac poems and meditations on death and dying. There's a poem in there about Pope John Paul II. There's a poem about an Argentine poet, Alejandra Pizarnik, and then there are many poems about friends and family members of mine who have passed away. So that was the theme of the second one.
And then another 3 years later, Thank You for Dreaming. Tell us about that, how it got published, and the content.
Mm-hmm. So that one was actually published by a kind of renegade poet, you know, I mean, I almost want to say like he's Charles Bukowski-like, except minus the womanizing and excessive drinking in that. But his name is Rain Dog, he goes by, R.D. Armstrong, and he runs a press called Lummix Press. So if you know what Lummix means, it means a clumsy person, which is suitable for me because I often bump into things and fall over and stuff like that. But anyway, he does this journal, Lummix is the name of the journal. Every year it comes out. And I found out about it through Patrick Connors, a good friend of mine, a poet in Toronto. And he also does chapbooks with his small press, and he just liked my work and invited me to send some to him for consideration for a chapbook. And the content of it, really, it has a few threads, but the main one is immigration, immigrant rights, I wasn't even thinking of the dreamers as in DACA recipients when I wrote that book or the title poem in it, but I was thinking more generally about migration and the need for justice and people's basic freedom of movement that should be a human right. And also, along with that, the theme of women's rights. And so some of the poems in that chapbook involve retelling of certain myths from female perspectives or looking at different significant women from history but from a different perspective, like Frida Kahlo, like Dido, like the lover of Augustine, Una, whose real name is not even known. You know, all we know is that Saint Augustine converted to Catholicism and left her and a small son behind, basically, when he then went on to pursue a religious life. So, yeah, that's the third chapbook.
As did Merton, but his child died during the war. His child that he had in England. You mentioned Bukowski. That's interesting. He got me. He really got me writing again, or writing for the first time poetry. I published articles and many articles and journals on my field, technology. After 35 years, I happened to pick up one of his books, and I said, he's a drunk, and he's a misogynist, and he's crazy, but he's brilliant, and if he can do this, maybe I can too. And so he was an inspiration to me, in spite of his weirdness, but and to a lot of people, I think. How about another poem?
Sure. Okay. This one is called Gray Wingless Angels, and this one actually was originally published in the journal, the Lummox Journal, by Rain Dog Armstrong. People fly in and out of our lives. I hold them if I can. Is it wrong to yearn for intimacies that don't swing? Who will turn around and say it? You are not alone in the world. When a wild-haired, shoeless man shows up at the door, should I really send him away barefoot? I gave him your flip-flops. Hope you don't mind. It isn't altruism. It's seeing my possible, not improbable future knocking at my door, glaring into my eyes and smiling. He's 72, my mother's age. No wife, no children, no bed. He's a leaf who fell from November maples and hit rock bottom, only to find there was no rock on the bottom. He asks for a glass of milk. I pour it. I offer him English muffins with honey. My mouth is like a baby's, he declares, relishing the joy of no more teeth. The love you have is the love you give. There isn't any more. He wraps his scarf around his neck, back to face the November wind. What would you do if you had no keys at all? If cafe owners shooed you away? If librarians tapped you on the shoulder and told you it was time to go?
Yeah, and that is so important now. I mean, I've talked to people who've just come back from San Francisco, where it's homeless all over. We're so caught up in everything that's going on with as you mentioned, with the dreamers and with the immigrants, that they're also perhaps losing track of people that have been around for a long time in our own cities and everything. It's a real tragedy that we can so harden ourselves to people on the street who, for whatever reason, whether it's alcoholism, drugs, or have just fallen on bad times that we just ignore them. How did you get into the translation of poetry?
That started when I was a college student. It was part of my Spanish classes. It was included in the pedagogy of the professors. It was part of what they had us do. And I found I really needed to at the beginning just to understand what I was reading. I started out in a class on Latin American surrealism, and my Spanish was pretty good, but I had never read anything like that before, and there was a lot of new vocabulary, so I just started looking up words. There was no Google Translate at that point, no smartphone I just held in my hand, so I used a physical dictionary and started working that way, and I got more and more into it. And so I mentioned that I went to Uruguay on a Fulbright to do a translation project. That was what I proposed. Part of my work down there was teaching as well, being a teaching assistant in public schools. But the translation was really the main thing that I was doing and kept doing. I've kept doing it ever since.
Please tell us something about, and hopefully I'll pronounce it correctly, Amorosa Di Gennaro, who you've translated four of her books into one volume, I remember, Nightfall. Tell us something about her poetry, and why did you combine them into one book rather than publish individual books?
So Amorosa Di Gennaro was born in 1932 in a small city, but in Uruguay, it's the second biggest city. So Uruguay has this unusual situation where it's a country of 3 million people, and half of them are in the capital city, Montevideo, which is on the river, you know, which runs into the ocean there near Buenos Aires, the Rio de la Plata. So the other half of the people are scattered throughout the country in small towns and cities. So Salto, where she was born, is just 150,000 people, but it's the second largest city in the country. So that's where she was born, and it was a farm on the outskirts of the city, and that is what really influenced her, growing up on a farm, and just having this sense of everything infused with magic. Her writing is just filled with strange images, gods, demons, angels, monsters. She was raised Catholic, so Catholicism plays a big role in there. But when I started reading her, she reminds me of William Blake, just this visionary type of poetry. So, yeah, that's Amorosa Di Gennaro. And the other part of the question was why did I put them all together like that? She herself did that with her own books. She published them individually and then came out with volumes that had more than one book in it. And so that was just what I ended up doing with my publisher for that.
You have a translation from another poet, Romina Defresky, is it, coming out this year as Echo of the Park. Would you do the same thing? Tell us something about her and her work.
Yes. So very, very different experience working on each of them because Di Gennaro died in 2004, so I never met her in person. But Romina Freschi is younger and very much alive. She lives in Buenos Aires, Argentina. She has a preteen daughter. She started publishing at a very young age, and her work has really changed and evolved a lot. Like, her early writing was kind of outrageous and very ironic and a lot of parody and a lot of social critique. And I'd still say there's social critique in the book that I translated, Echo of the Park, but it's much more subtle. It's a book-length poem. It is philosophical. It engages with a lot of different ideas from figures like Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, whom, if you don't know her, was a very, very famous Mexican nun and feminist, early feminist. We're talking 1500s, you know, so it was colonial Mexico. And she's a very much a founding figure of Latin American literature. So Romina Freshy engages with her and with other writers and philosophical ideas, and it's all about our human relationship with the rest of nature and this idea that we think that we're separate from nature. At the same time, we want to bond with animals and connect with them. Part of the book came from her experience of taking care of a wild bird that was injured, and she took care of it while it was being restored to health, and sort of our complex relationship with, I'm putting it in air quotes, nature, because, you know, we are nature, but just in a time of a lot of destruction. So that's the theme of that book.
The friend and our previous guest on this show, M. Tafola, have translated works from the French, and she and the poet have become close and have appeared at conferences together. Have you gotten into that kind of relationship with Romina?
I mean, it's really funny because I met Romina back in 2013 when I was in Buenos Aires for some research as part of my dissertation, and I just met with her to discuss other things. I never thought I'd end up translating her. And this particular book, which Echo of the Park, which just came out with a new press called Eulalia Books, they actually asked me to do it. So it was a really interesting reconnection because I had met her and then not spoken to her for many years. And definitely through talking on Skype and all of that, I definitely feel I've gotten to know her. I'd say at this point our relationship is more professional than personal, but she's a lovely person, and she's someone that I would like to get to know better. In fact, I'm hoping that at some point during this academic year she might be traveling to the U.S., and I might get to meet her. I'm hoping, you know, to meet her again, so I'm hoping for that.
Do the books contain, as some do, both the original Spanish and the English, or just the English?
So I've really appreciated that thus far for all of the poetry that I've published in translation from the Spanish, bilingual versions have been published. And I think that that is really the best way, because especially in a language like Spanish, where there are plenty of people who do speak both languages. I mean, it certainly means that there's some pressure on the translator, knowing that people are going to be flipping back from the original to the translation and looking and comparing. But that's really the art, you know. It highlights having both languages there. It highlights that translation really is an art in itself. You know, it's not like you type something into Google Translate and you get another word out. Like, no, it takes a lot of thought and craft and creativity, and it's really exciting. So I'm really happy that the Spanish and English appear side by side in these books.
That brings us to another question. Another previous guest, Bruce Pearl, translates the work of an ancient Roman poet into modern English, including some very strong sexual vulgarities. Does this come up in your work?
Sexual vulgarities or vast differences of time?
Translating it into English that's street English rather than flowery English.
I get it. Yeah. I mean, that kind of issue comes up all the time. Sure.
Okay. It seems like it's a good break point for another poem. Do you want to give us one of your translations, or do you want to give us one of your own? Completely up to you.
I'd love to give a translation. Is there time for me to read in Spanish and English both, do you think, or do I need to just read the English?
Do both.
Do both, thank you. All right. Habitar así los terrenos imperfectos, parquizarlos, de continuo generar la pátina que haga posible una vida allí, de continuo la vida es sostener esa pátina, y allí donde fallamos, morir, ver morir. Che, ¿acaso la civila no se civiliza? No hay civilización que no pase su manto hipócrita sobre la muerte que sostiene, el fuerte que desmorona. Ay, Juana, vos y tu sueño sobre el mío, como un corazón que late, sibilante, en la falla del hábito. To inhabit, then, imperfect terrain, to parkify it, constantly creating the patina that makes life possible. There, constantly, life means to seal that patina. And there, where we fail to die, to watch die, hey, maybe the Sibyl can't be civilized. There's no civilization that doesn't spread its hypocritical cover over all the death that holds up the crumbling fortress. Oh, Juana, you and your dream on mine, like a heart that beats sibilant in the fault lines of habit.
Now, which one was that from? To which of your two poets?
Sorry, I should have said. That's Romina Freshy, and it's from Echo of the Park.
Okay.
Kind of from the middle of it. It's a book-length poem, so it's from the middle of it.
You had a full-length collection of your own poetry, Things Seen and Unseen, published this year. Please tell us about this work.
This is my first full-length collection, and it's pretty personal to me. I mean, all writing is personal, but I think it's especially close to me because I started writing the poems in it probably in about 2003, and the last poem that's in here comes from about 2015. And I never envisioned this, like up until quite recently, like for all these books, really, my level of composition has always been the individual poem. I don't write poems with a whole book in mind, although for the next book, I kind of am doing that. But up until now, I've always worked at the level of the individual poem. And so, I mean, it was a long process of compiling work that I'd done over many years. And it was published in Canada, and for various reasons, the publication was delayed. It was supposed to come out in 2016, and it took 3 extra years. And I actually never thought for certain that it would come out. So the fact that it has is really meaningful to me.
You've also had things published in other journals, and one that I'm aware of is this Catholic Women's Speak, at least by the title. What is that, and what do you have in it?
Catholic Women's Speak is not a journal. Catholic Women's Speak is an organization online, global in reach, and it is a group of Catholic women from all over the world who speak about whatever we want to speak about to one another and to the people, mostly men, who run the institutional church. And the group has put out 2 volumes of prose essays, generally in response to synods that the Vatican has put on. So a few years ago, 3 years ago, there was a synod on the family, and no women were invited to be present at it, at this very important, you don't have families without women. Well, you can, but, you know, not traditional ones. And so no women were present at this, event, right? And so the group met in Rome in response and put on a conference and came out with this book with women writing about all their thoughts on all sorts of things, family, marriage, position in the church, all that kind of stuff. And then 3 years later, there was going to be a synod on vision, on vocation, youth and vocation, and some women were invited, but they were not given voting privileges. So once again, we, and under the leadership, I must mention, of Tina Beatty, who is the mastermind behind this over in London, in the UK, put together a book called Visions and Vocations. And you mentioned before your friend Therese at Crane Birch, who listens to the program, she and I both have an essay in this latest book, which came out last year. And we met at the symposium that was held in Rome in October of last year.
I knew there wasn't a journal. I knew there was. There were two anthologies published. I misspoke.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to your writing and translation work, you're a college professor in Iowa. Please tell us about your academic history. Was that your? Have you been there ever since you started teaching, or were you at other colleges? And what did you teach in Iowa now?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, I started teaching, my first year of teaching was at a private bilingual international high school in Nicaragua, and that was back in 2007, 2008. And I did teach all through graduate school, first as a teaching assistant, but I taught Spanish language, had my own class. I was part of a literature class, ran seminars, things like that. And then I also, after I got my PhD, I briefly taught as an adjunct professor a wonderful literature class called Canons and Canonicity. I mean, it was, the course was established before I came on board, but I just did my own thing with it. And it was all about how we form canons of literature, music, even science, like how do we decide what information is important and what is less important and all of the power dynamics that go into that. And then I got a full-time tenure track job at the University of Dubuque in Iowa. Dubuque is on the Mississippi River at the border of Illinois and Wisconsin. We're about 3 hours due west of Chicago over land. And I teach various things. I've taught Spanish. I coordinate our Spanish minor. I teach global literature. I teach general education literature courses. I've taught ESL to some of our students from Saudi Arabia. We have about 200 from Saudi Arabia on campus. And this semester, I have one section of an English class for students who come a little bit underprepared to college, so it's intro to college writing, and I'm really excited to work with those students.
What's next for you?
Well, what's next for me after getting off the phone with you is looking at the big pile of grading I have to do for my students for this week. In terms of translation, I plan to keep writing and translating, that's for sure. I hope to never stop. I hope to keep doing those activities as long as I'm living. So I do have another poetry project in mind. I'm not hurrying with it. I did just have a book come out, so I'm taking my time. But it's loosely themed on the choices that we make in life and the limits imposed by those choices and the limits we impose on one another and the desire to go beyond those limits. I know that sounds a little vague, but some of the things that I'm reading for it are, for example, Kierkegaard's writings, either or. I'm looking into some Thomas Merton for it as well. And in terms of translation, a very dear friend of mine who's also a translator and big Uruguay booster, her name's Jessie Lee Kercheval, we decided to team up to translate an Uruguayan poet called Silvia Guerra, who is challenging to say the least, probably more challenging than Romina Freshy, whom I just read from, but really, really interesting work. And I think we've found that for this project, sometimes translators find that two heads are better than one. So it's been really fun working on this project with a friend.
We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
What would I like the audience to know about me? Just that I hope that I imagine if you're listening to this show, you're people who enjoy reading, possibly you enjoy writing. One thing I want people to know is that writing is for everyone. It's not for just an educated minority. It's not for an elite. Anybody can write poetry. I would say start with just, you know, just describe the house you grew up in, or write about something red. I mean, these are sort of silly prompts, right? But that's what can get you going. And anybody can do it. And I think it's just a really amazing way to express oneself, but also form community and empathy with other people. And we need more of that, you know, right now. And reading as well. Reading goes with writing. I would urge people to read outside the box, read books in translation. Only 3% of what's published in the U.S. is in translation from other languages. We get kind of insular and neglect to think about other cultures or even diversity within our own. So, yeah, I'd urge people to read widely. And as far as writing goes, I always dreamed of writing a book. Never thought I would do it until now. So, and, you know, once you've done it, you realize it's an amazing blessing, but it's something that anybody, I believe, who tries can do.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. And I thank Therese for the recommendation. Oh, would you take us off with another poem?
Sure, yeah. All right. So this one was written actually in 2010, and it's in my full-length book. But, yeah, it's for our country right now. It's called Seeds. She is my sister. I had never visited her family's shanty, just as she had never seen my house in the suburbs. She always wore the same yellow dress on her way to the market to sell chewing gum, while I wore a starched plaid uniform on my way to school. Each morning we met on a grassy field halfway between our homes. We walked hand in hand, picking flowers, sharing secrets only the ground beneath could hear. Then, one morning, they came with their shovels. "Stand back," they cried. Dazed, we watched as they started to dig a ditch and built a chain-linked fence separating us. After they with their shovels had left, we still passed friendship bracelets through holes in the fence, picked dandelions that grew alongside, and blew their seeds so they would grow thick and fast and knock the fence down. But as teenagers, we found the chain link fence replaced by a wooden one with gaps thin as wafers through which I barely glimpsed her face. We still wove flowers through grooves, still scattered seeds. Now that we're adults, a high brick wall divides us. Each morning, I go alone, wondering if she's there on the other side, if she too is pressing her hands against that wall, kneeling down to plant seeds that will one day be climbing roses. Somehow, I know she too believes we are sisters, and halfway between our homes, there is still an open grassy meadow with only the sky and the ground as fences.
That's so apropos to what's going on now. That's terrific. Send any comments to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join me again next week. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs for previous shows, schedule of upcoming shows, and a bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, as are Janine's. Now, in the words of the Met radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book, and until next time. As he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off to Once Again with the Eagles and Taking It Easy. Thank you again, Janine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Play Taking It Easy.
What do you want me to play?
Taking It Easy.
Take It Easy from your library, starting now on Amazon Music.
Thanks again, Janine, and good night, everybody.